the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fucknicks, what the fuckadelics, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron, this is my podcast. Today on the show, Billie Jean King. I got an opportunity to talk to her because she has a memoir out called All In, an autobiography. But here's a deal with Billie Jean King. A lot of people know her mostly for the Battle of the Sexes match against Bobby Riggs, but the truth is, she's one of the most important and influential figures in the ongoing fight for equal rights. She won 39 Grand Slam titles, 12 of them in singles. She formed the first all-women's tennis tour with 8 other pro players that led to the founding of the Women's Tennis Association. She testified in Congress on behalf of Title IX funding, which made discrimination based on gender illegal in all federally funded school programs, including sports. She's the real deal. Just amazing. I mean, I just remember her always being there. I do want to inform you people that we are recording these a little out. Like Brendan's, he's on vacation this week, so I put these in the can last week, so it's not going to be as topical. Though tomorrow, if this time's out right, I'm supposed to be playing at Largo tonight if I don't have COVID. I'm literally testing. So I will be able to tell you how that goes or didn't go on Thursday, because that'll time out right. I don't need to explain the days, but we are doing these early, that's all. But I can't talk about tennis. I can talk about tennis. There was a point in my brother and my life where, I wouldn't say I was a sports guy. A lot of you know the story about me in Little League. Not great. And also, I'm starting to realize, and this is something I'd like to share with my psychiatrist and psychologist, mostly psychologist, people in the therapy racket, I've had a sort of cathartic realization that seems logical, and I'm sure I'm not the first to have thought about it. But I started to realize, just given who I am, that one of the primary realities of my life when I was younger, for as far back as I remember, is that I felt awkward. I didn't feel like I fit in. At some point, I learned how to be funny, and I could do a little song and dance, a little show, a little smart-ass crack. I used to be able to sort of get in under the wire with the wit. But I never felt that comfortable in my skin or in life or in friendships or around people. I just didn't. So if you're that kind of person, I would say that 95% of your memories are going to be embarrassing and mildly traumatic. So that means that you sort of exist in a kind of like aggravated, mild PTSD just from being uncomfortable your entire life. And even when you get comfortable, the residual effects of that discomfort, of that mild PTSD from being embarrassed, the insecurity that comes from feeling like an idiot or feeling out of place, or just, you can never get any sort of social traction, or you just said the wrong thing all the time. It's just like, I don't think it can be understated. I think that's life-defining shit and very hard to get out from under. Why am I telling you all this? I don't know. At some point, I realized that sports weren't for me. At some point, my brother went the way of the tennis player. We were both at a place called New England Tennis Camp. My brother and I were equals at that time. I remember it was a summer where we were sent to two camps. That was how my parents spent their money. My father was a doctor, and my mother was a painter and an artist. And I think that once summer came around, in the guise of wanting us to have a good time, they just wanted us out of the house. Two camps in one summer, come on. So there was like the Lighthouse Arts Camp. That was great. I talked to you about that traumatic event of playing Johnny B. Goode badly. Some guy who was in that band with me when I was 14 at the Lighthouse Arts and Music Community, he wrote me out of nowhere. The guy, Matt, I believe he played piano, but in my mind it was bass, but maybe he played piano. Either way, he said, wow, man, I don't remember it that way. I don't remember it being that bad. See, now again, that's where this plays in, that if you feel uncomfortable, you feel awkward, everything's going to feel shitty. But you know what? It was bad. He was high. He was one of the high guys. There was no way he could have registered what was happening. So I disagree with his memory of the situation. It was terrible, and it was destroyed my confidence in music for the rest of my life. So apparently he's working in the music business, not as a musician. But see, that's how it goes. Anyways, tennis camp. So there was a time where it was tennis all the time, and we went to this tennis camp. We played all the time, me and my brother. But like that was a couple of things happened at tennis camp. One, I played okay, was never great, never gave a shit. One thing that happened was that my roommate was a guy, real jappy, kind of a Long Island guy named Stu, who, you know, I eventually grew to he kind of annoyed me, and I just resented him. And I was hanging out with another guy named Peter Blumenthal, whose dad was an executive at NBC, which plays into my life later, but also smoked cigarettes. He was kind of tiny guy. I wonder what happened to that guy. I don't know what happened to that guy. But, you know, we were at tennis camp, and I would hang out with the guys who smoked. So that's where I was at. But Stu annoyed me. So here, let's just set this straight. Stu, listen to me. I'm sorry I don't remember your last name. But I got to tell you, I did steal the Red Octopus cassette. I did. I know I said I didn't. I know you know I did. I know it was your cassette. I liked it, but I didn't like it that much. I just didn't like you. And I don't know why. It was, you know, I'm not a stealing kind of guy, but I did. I took it. I took the Jefferson Starship Red Octopus record. I looked you right in the face. I said I didn't, but I did. And I need to get that off my heart. I'm sorry. It was nothing personal. I'm not a thief. I just, you annoyed me. And I took the cassette. Didn't even like it that much. Okay, back to tennis. So Craig, my brother's jamming on the tennis, doing great. I can hit a ball, like I said, pretty good, but me and Blumenthal are hanging out. Another thing I realize is that looking back on it, these counselors at these camps were like 19 years old. When you're younger, you're like, who are these old guys? And how come they're all, you know, hooking up and fucking? That was happening. I had this crush on a counselor there. I think her name was Betty. And this guy, Rogoff, I think his name was Bruce. He had the room down the hall. It was all at this, it was in Pawling, New York, on the campus of a college. He had the room, and he had this whole wall, it seemed, of, you know, assembled plastic cassette shelves with TDK cassettes of his entire record collection. It was just a setup for fucking outside of the bunk bed. So he was having sex with this woman who I was, you know, had a crush on, but I was like 14, and she was probably 20, 22, and I think she was hanging out with this guy, Bruce, down the hall. It was all very upsetting. But me and Blumenthal were smoking cigarettes. So it turns out Blumenthal, his old man, this comes out of tennis, that's why I'm talking about it, is an executive at NBC. And as many of you remember, I talk about his father set up for me a tour of studio, what is it, 8H or whatever it is, the Saturday Night Live one, because I wanted to meet Belushi. So I drive into the city with my grandma Goldie, and this guy's dad set up this meeting. So that was the time we went up there, and we were waiting to meet Belushi, and a very seemingly high Al Franken comes out. Hey, how you doing? And we're like, I just want to meet John Belushi. I was 14 with my grandma. And he's like, John's busy. John's busy. Sorry. And wandered off, Franklin in his giant Jufro. But that was my first experience at the SNL building, which was disappointing. And then the next experience I had was auditioning and being rejected for the show. And that all comes from tennis. That's my point. You know, tennis, you know, sometimes it can take you places you didn't quite anticipate. You know what I'm saying? That's all I'm saying. My brother went on to become a semi-pro tennis player. He went to Nick Bollettieri's Tennis Institute. He played tennis all his life, all through college. He set up a business after college, a tennis teaching business. And then at some point, it just stopped. Poor kid didn't have the natural gift, which you need to go all the way. Worked his ass off. And now, like, I think for years, he just didn't even fucking think about it. Didn't even look at a racket. Didn't even pick it up. And he's a guy because, you know, he's got all that muscle memory. He could just pick up a racket and in 10 minutes beat most of us. He's just that good. My brother, Craig, he doesn't even play recreationally, but now he's like, I think he's a pickleball addict. I don't even know what that is, but I think he has a pickleball problem. Billie Jean King has a new book out. It's called All In, an autobiography. It's available now wherever you get books. And this is me talking to the legend over Zoom. Are you signing autographs?
I would love to, but nobody's here to sign them for.
Oh, you're just making some notes?
No, but I did. No, I am signing. No, I'm learning about you, Mark.
Oh, you want to interview me?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen. Oop, you dropped my mic again.
Those are the lavalier mics. They're way behind in their technology somehow.
Yes, they are. You are very observant, but you work in this biz all the time.
I do. How do you feel about being in show business this few weeks?
Well, I think as a player, we are a performer. I think yeah. I've been through this before. It's all right. I like it. I like communication. I like people. That's what I like. Yeah, I do. I really like people.
Well, it's interesting to me because I was thinking back on you and in my experience of you in the world, you have been ubiquitous through my entire life. Seriously. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and it was just, you were always around.
Yes, I was around a lot in the 70s, I guess. But I've seen you on a lot of shows. When did you start doing those night shows? I mean,
oh, the stand-up?
Yeah.
I guess I started that. I really started doing that in the late 80s. You know, I've been around. I've been working it. And I've been,
That's a hard job. I don't know how you guys do it. How do you get the guts to do that every night? Especially if they don't laugh or don't do what you want.
Well, you know, there's a certain amount of self-torture. You know, not unlike competitive sports. Yeah, the risk of losing is always there, and you just fight against it. Except the game is not as specific. You know, there's a lot of
it's more subjective. Yes, definitely,
absolutely. I was like when I was like going through your book, and that you made a big book. It's got a lot of weight to it. Quite a life.
It's really heavy. I noticed that too. We got it down to that. It was over 800 pages.
Oh my God.
I'm old, man. I'm going to be 78 this year. I'm living large. I've had a great life so far, and I hope I continue, but there's no guarantees, as you know, in life, so.
Yeah. I mean, 800, did you, like, how long did it take you to write it?
Spent over 4.5 years on it.
And do you, like, when you were doing it, were there periods where, like, you were writing and you were kind of amazed?
No, you know what? I don't write that much. I have to talk it.
So you
And
talk.
I had people help. But no, right. I spent the time talking it, looking at it, correcting it, editing, I'm not a bad editor. I'm not a great writer.
I'm the same way.
I can edit like crazy. And I just spent time talking, doing interviews, we'd sit at the dining room table. That dining room table's got a lot of stories there. And just tape, write. I talk it better, and people keep asking me questions or whatever, and then I just keep figuring it out.
Yeah, talking it is much better.
It's a long process, wow. But it's worth it. You know, you want to get it right. And I had to leave so many people out, which I hate, my friends and things. But you know what? You can't make the book 400 pages even if you don't do that. So
when you were telling the stories, were there moments like, you know, when you're going through your mind that you were kind of amazed or you found in recollecting this life of yours, what was it like the most pivotal things that, you know, you for like when you were younger, do you remember turning points where you're like,
I definitely had two or three turning points. Absolutely. And then they've lived on with me forever because of those turning points. And I think if you talk to most people, ask them questions. If they talk about their youth,
yeah,
they'll have their turning points. Did you?
Yeah, I think so. None of them were great. You know, like.
But what was a really important turning point? What do you remember your first turning point?
Like in professionally, you know, I definitely remember the first time I failed on stage and just the horrible trauma of.
Was that the first time you'd ever been on stage or was it later?
That was later. The first, again, and another time I was on stage, which I was just talking about recently, is I did terribly. And like, I'm starting to look back at my life and I realize that most of my. I find that if you're an awkward person or you feel uncomfortable when you're younger, almost all of your experiences are going to be embarrassing or traumatic. That's been my experience.
I understand that. That's who you are. That's your personality. Yeah.
So like when I look back, I'm just sort of like, oh, God, that was terrible. Oh, my God. How did I get through that?
I'm like that a lot. It's never good enough.
Right.
Yeah, I am. But that's also what drives me. And I love that drive. So it's like. Yeah, like the losses stay with you and you don't want to feel that feeling again. And you're just like, you know, give me the ball. You
right.
Know, it's like,
but
yeah.
At least you had a context and the context was tennis. For me, it was just sort of like, how do I charm these people better?
I in a different way than what you're talking, because you're entertainment. When you go in to get sponsorship in business, or if you're trying to change things, then it's exhausting. And you do have to learn how to talk with people. How do you get them to move? How do you get them to agree? And also, maybe they come up with much better ideas than you have, so you've got to actively listen all the time, because maybe they're going to come up with a better idea as well. So you just got to keep listening as you go through the process.
But when you were like a kid, though, like, do you remember, do you know where it came from? Do you remember where your sort of being hard on yourself came from?
I think my dad, maybe watching him, he was really intense when he was in sports. In fact, he was so intense, he got carried off a few times. And my mother and my brother and I would be sitting watching him, like, you know, this is when he's older, obviously. Yeah. In Firefighters League, they had a basketball league because my dad was very good in basketball. Oh, yeah, he'd want to go punch the referee or something. And I'm like,
oh, my God.
And my mother and we go, oh, God, this is horrible. And they pull him off and take him off. And and then I start smiling. And my mother goes, what are you smiling at? And I said, Mom, you know, I think he's horrible. He's terrible. But I love his intensity. I love it. Because that's what makes greatness. I said, Mom, I just love that part of Daddy. And she says, oh, I love that part, too. But he just, you know, it's like...
That's so funny.
So I would take the good part of somebody, I think, and aspect of them, and then I'd keep it.
Right.
Like I'd say, thanks, Dad. You gave kind of like a gift to me.
Right.
And then my mother would give me another gift, and that is not always going off the deep end or something. And she would be, you know, very kind and...
Grounded?
Very grounded. Boy, did she keep my brother and me grounded. Grounded.
Yeah.
Talk about sometimes taking the enthusiasm out. But you know what? It was good because we were crazed and obsessed with what we wanted to achieve. So they really accepted that part of us and tried to keep it calm. And my mother particularly would keep it calm and, like you said, grounded. And
yeah. It's interesting, though, when you have intense, like dad. My dad was very intense. And as I get older, you really do have to sort of sort out. You know, like, all right, there was some bad stuff there.
But yes.
What do I have that is great about that guy?
What do you think? What do you think is the greatest thing for your dad? What do you think?
Well, I think that at his best, he's a passionate guy. He's charismatic. He's engaged. He likes to laugh. But you know, he was a little, you know, manic and a little crazy and a little unpredictable and a bit abusive.
Yeah, I get it. But sounds like you took the best parts.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got the other ones. I've just
got to put them. I know. Well, I got some of the others. I have anger. I had to work on my anger, but I worked on it really hard, and I don't have it anymore. I got rid of it. I don't even feel the same or anything. It's great.
Really?
No, but I went to therapy, and I still do therapy. Are you kidding? I worked hard in therapy. You know what? You got to work it. If you go to therapy, it's the same as doing anything else. You got to work it. If you want to go for an hour or 50 minutes and then not think about it or feel about it or do anything, then you're not going to get that much better. If you accept the responsibility of it and really want to get in there, I think it can make a big difference.
Oh, yeah, of course. And as you get older, you know exactly why you're there.
Yeah, I need to be there. Yeah, we're there because I need to be here and I need to do this. I need to do this for myself and, quite frankly, for others.
Yeah, you know where you're stuck. Like, what were your primary issues when he started?
What, therapy?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was probably my sexuality and my parents, my dad's anger issues, definitely.
Yeah.
But I loved his intensity. I loved both of their passion. I mean, they just, when they believe in something, it's 100%, which I loved.
Somehow your parents created two professional athletes. I mean, so there must have been some sort of like kind of driving element. I mean, was he overly pressuring?
Oh, absolutely not. They're the opposite. That's the reason we were crazed, because we could be, and they are always trying to temper it. Like, no, no, no. Randy wanted to be a Major League Baseball player by the time he was 10. At 11, I told my mom and dad I wanted to be the best tennis player in the world. Of course, I didn't know anything about tennis because I grew up in team sports. And basketball was our first love. And Randy ends up being a, you know, professional baseball player for 12 years, 10 of those with the San Francisco Giants and then with the Astros and Blue Jays. And I got to be number one in the world and more than once, so a lot more than once. And I got really very fortunate. But we were born with their coordination. But they really only cared about health and education. As long as we're healthy and happy, And so they gave us space. They didn't. They never asked us if we won. You know how parents always go, did you win? Did you win? And they hover. You know, they're like snowplow parents, and they never want them to suffer. And then, you know, their helicopter, they're always hovering over them. And they, you know, just being so intense with their children, and they have to win. Oh, my parents didn't care at all about that. We're the ones that were crazed. I mean, we drove them nuts. Oh, I can't believe I lost. And, you know, my dad said, calm down, you're okay. This is when my dad was a great life coach. Calm down. Do you think you're playing too much? Not enough? Do you still love it? I said, are you kidding? I love it. I can't stand it. I'm losing. And he said, well.
Was that your whole life? That was the dynamic when he was alive?
He was amazing, but he was also a firefighter. So he was away every other night. My mother, so it was the three of us, and then the four of us, then the three of us, then the four of us. And then we'd also go down to the fire station sometimes and see him and the other guys and the other firefighters. And when I was a baby, he used to take me down the pole when I was like 3, 4 years old. Daddy.
Oh, that's exciting.
That was so awesome.
So you had firefighters around all the time, like parties, backyard?
My uncle was a firefighter.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I did have it around. And my dad, he was also a police officer for a while. He didn't like it. He was losing faith in humanity. He said it's too tough on him. He loved being a firefighter. He drove the truck. Every time I see a fire truck go by, I salute it and go, "Hi, Daddy." So
Sweet. So my brother was committed to tennis for years, and then he just realized at some point that he didn't have the natural talent to be.
Did he want to be a pro?
He did. He was, you know, he was sort of ranked in doubles one time. He went to Nick Bollettieri's Tennis Institute.
No, that's real. Nick is wonderful.
Yeah, it was hardcore.
What's your brother's name?
Craig Maron. That was his whole life when he was a kid. So I was always on the outside of this tennis life. He was at it all the time. And at some point, he just realized he didn't have the natural ability that would take him over the top. So he just gave it up. It was brutal.
So he really wanted it then.
He did.
Does he play at all recreationally?
Not. He just like stopped. After college, he taught for a while, and then he was just sort of like, it was like never again, you know. He plays that pickleball thing.
Pickleball's great. Maybe he's disappointed.
Yeah, you got to be. It's got to be kind of heartbreaking.
He'd be a good podcast for you, you know. I couldn't resist. Sorry.
So when did you start feeling that, you know, that I guess it probably happened naturally, that it was your responsibility to sort of start taking on the fights that you took on?
That was at 12 years old.
Really?
When I had my epiphany at the Los Angeles Tennis Club. I grew up in Long Beach, California. And when I started playing, I'd been playing tennis for a year. I already knew I wanted to be number one. That happened really early. That was the second time I was on a tennis court. So fast forward to 12 years old, I'm at the Los Angeles Tennis Club, and I'm daydreaming, and I started thinking about my sport, because I came from team sports, and I thought about it, and I thought, well, everybody's wearing white socks, white shoes, white clothes, plays with white balls, and everybody who plays is white. And I hadn't seen a person of color yet play tennis, so I'm like, where's everyone else? So I started thinking about it. I also wanted to travel and see the world and learn and was curious. It drove my parents crazy because they're always asking questions and curious. And so I started to realize that I could travel with it. And I just remembered I was going to promise myself I'd fight for equality the rest of my life after seeing that. I just knew that was what I was meant to do. And that tennis, God willing, if I could become number one, I knew as a girl that I had a disadvantage because of my gender, that people probably wouldn't listen to me, but maybe if I could become number one, they might. And I was going to fight for this the rest of my life. And I made that promise to myself. I have not veered from that course ever. And I just got really lucky that tennis provided the platform and the travel and also a way to, you know, fight for equality and fight for everyone. Every single person needs to be represented. You know, they need,
absolutely.
You know, so I just think it's important. And I just know that sports is, we're very fortunate, and just like you, you're fortunate that people see
sure.
to try to help make this world a better place. And it's just, I love
and
it.
Early on, how did you manage your anger? I mean, were there situations?
Not too well. I had a temper on the court. My dad said, of course, this is ironic. This is just perfect.
Right.
I threw my racket. My dad says, that's it. You cannot throw your racket. You're a bad sport. You can't do that. And of course, I'm looking at him like, really?
Yeah, coming so
he,
from you?
We have a power saw in the garage. And he turns it on and takes my one and only racket, puts it with about an in, within about an inch of the blade. And I'm going, Daddy, stop. I promise I won't throw it anymore because I want to play tennis, right?
Right.
I can see my tennis going out the window right now with one little, you know, with right through the saw there. So he says, okay. And then after I had my racket in my hand, I said, Daddy, I mean, really, are you really one to talk? And he started laughing so hard because he knew. He totally busted, okay? He was totally busted, totally.
Boy.
I
also,
said, I got him. Gotcha, Dad.
The drama of guillotining the racket. I mean, that's like, you know, he turned the saw on.
And oh, my God. He turned it on. He made it so dramatic. I could just.
Yeah, that's great.
So my dad and my. Yeah, he was pretty intense.
But like, what about the anger? Did you find yourself angry at male players?
Because
of their entitlement?
Yes and no. But I wanted the men and women to be together. Everything with me is to unite, okay?
Yeah.
It's to unite, not divide. So I'm big on, I wanted the women's and men, the men and women to be together in an association, for instance, which would be the same as a union, but we're independent contractors, so we can't be called a union, but to have one voice as a sport. And the guys just kept rejecting us. So, yeah, I was upset with them. And they were really great guys. I mean, I used to go to dinner with them, dancing, everything. I really liked them. We were like friends. But when it came to money, they thought it all belonged to them. And Larry, my former husband, told me, he said, Billy, if we ever get professional tennis, which we did in 1968, they will think every dime belongs to them. They will want you to go away. And I said, oh, no, Larry, these guys are my friends. They're really great guys. No, that won't happen. He says, Billy, and when it's money, they think the money only belongs to them, that you guys don't earn any money, you don't draw any people, you don't do anything. And he said, get ready. And Larry was completely right, and I was completely wrong. So that was a wake-up call. But was I disappointed? Was I upset? Yes. It happened to be the men I was upset because they're the ones that wanted us out. Not because of their gender, though, because of their actions. And I still think we should be together. And I will always think that until the day I die. So there we go.
Well, I mean, when you testified in Congress on behalf of
Title IX?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, at that point you had, you know, some celebrity. You were a respected athlete. And I imagine that must have been very rewarding to take it to the government and to,
yes,
you know, to shift the perception legally.
Well, I promoted Title IX, but I didn't pass it. The government, I mean, the Senate.
No, of course,
House,
right.
But the, you know, I had three sheroes and one hero. Senator Birch Bayh was the one that got it through the Senate, the Title IX, and he actually wrote out the 37 words. He was just amazed what Title IX equaled later. And also, it helped get rid of quotas in the classroom. You know, before 1972, before Title IX was passed, there were classroom quotas, only 5%, 6%, whatever, could be women. And that's why we didn't have any women lawyers or doctors until after Title IX. And then also, we didn't have women's athletic scholarships until after Title IX was passed. So Title IX is one of the most important legal things that have been passed in the legislation in, I think, in the 20th century. It's probably top three.
Yeah, and it's amazing that, like, you know, before that, discrimination based on gender was just the way it was. And that's 1972.
Right. In 1973, when I played Bobby Riggs, we still couldn't get a credit card on our own. I mean, that sounds ridiculous now. You know,
it makes me
laugh, though, because what is it people always talk about women? They shop until they drop.
Right. Why couldn't you get a credit card?
And then why wouldn't you give her a credit card? You're going to make so much more money, right? I mean, it's ridiculous, but they do that.
But it's like, it's sort of that, you know, the idea that the marriage contract is ownership in some way. And that's really what all those rules are based on, that they cannot function or do anything without the approval or the consent of a man.
Correct.
Yeah, that's like, I feel bad. I feel like I can't believe that's so recent.
I know, but it's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, think about it, really.
And I remember when, in 1973, I was 10 years old, and I remember the match with Bobby Riggs and that, you know, the circus that it was presented as. But it did have an impact in a positive way for you and for people in general, don't you think?
Yes, it was about social change, and it also helped make Title IX more important. And also, it was only the third year of our women's professional tour, tennis tour. It was about social change, and it was 90 million people. That's a lot of people. And I knew that was my one moment to fight for equality and have all of these people hopefully would listen, which is always riding, you know, always walking on a tightrope, though, because you never know.
So you knew that.
Because you don't want to, okay, everything's audience. Well, you know that. God, who am I talking to? Hello? Anyway, everything's your audience. In my whole life, one thing I do understand as a performer, as a professional athlete, that everything, if you give a speech, it doesn't matter, but everything is your audience. They are the most important, each and every person. So I knew this was my one moment, but I also knew don't screw it up, because that would be very easy. And the one way to do that is to lose. So, oh, who's that girl? Oh, she's that girl that lost that old guy and whatever, how they remember. But and also, I could continue to, if I won, I could continue the fight a lot easier. Can you imagine? I said to myself, if you lose, oh my God, if I lose, I'm going to wake up every single day the rest of my life in the eyes of others, as I lost to this old guy. And I thought, I cannot think about that. Because every single day since that match, it's been mentioned to me or in some way there, okay?
Yeah.
Every single day. We're talking about it now, right? So I got, today's taken care of again. Every single day this match comes up.
You're eternally connected
to
Bobby Riggs.
But
you won.
I wanted to win. And if you win, that's what people remember. And I can't believe all the discussions and fights going on and the bets. Oh, my. The bets. You cannot believe the betting for that match. I mean, Vegas, everything was going crazy. And families were betting. And if she wins, you have to wash the dishes forever or make me coffee in the morning. And then if he wins, I'll do this. Oh, my gosh. It was like, and then they had all these parties in the burbs. All the fraternities and sororities had parties that night. I mean, it was crazy, because I've learned all about this after the fact. And everybody remembers where they were, you know. Anne Moore of Time Inc., she's left Time Inc. now, but she met her future husband that night. They decided to go watch the match by themselves.
Wow.
And she was engaged, so she had to I mean, I've heard so many great stories. Smith College went out in the streets with toilet paper throwing. Yay! I mean, it was crazy. So
wasn't it amazing when we all had just three channels to watch and everybody was on this?
But you make a lot more money now because you had to pay per.
But like, when did you realize that, you know, what, you know, after you did the Women's Tennis Tour and then the Women's Tennis Association, what was the relationship? How did the relationship develop between you and what was known or evolving as the women's movement? Right. So what?
I would sit with Gloria Steinem, Bella Abzug. I didn't really meet with Betty Friedan, but no, I knew about all that. I went to Gloria. She actually helped Larry and me. She and Pat Carbine, who was the editor of Ms. Magazine, they helped us. We started a women's sports magazine back, Larry and I did, in I think early 75 or late 74. And they were so helpful with that. So I was around them from a business point of view, but I also was trying to get Gloria to use us more in the women's movement, because a lot of times they didn't connect that sports was so much what they were fighting for, that we represented everything the women's movement's about, and that is winning, sweating.
Yeah.
It's okay to sweat. Oh, God forbid we're a woman, we can't sweat. No, we're real. We used all of ourselves. We trusted our body. Girls are taught not to trust their bodies. We trusted our bodies. We showed what it feels like, what it looks like to trust your bodies. And I said, Gloria, we are the essence. And we're on television every day just about. Use us more. Integrate us more.
Yeah.
And that was hard on them. Because they didn't come from that background.
Well, what was their resistance?
Well, the men understood. No, it's just lack of not living that and connecting with it like men connected with sports.
Right.
Right. And so the men understood what we were trying to do when I talked to them. And a lot of women understood it when we talked about it. But I couldn't quite get that, what I wanted. And I've talked to Gloria since. And, I mean, she finally said to me the other, like, 2 years ago, right before COVID. I'll never forget. There was a few of us on stage, but Gloria was there. And she came up to me, and this is the first time she went, "Billy, I got to talk to you. How was it playing that guy, Bobby Riggs? How was that? I can't imagine what that pressure was like. I can't, you know." And all of a sudden, I'm like, "Wow!" Now she's in her 80s, and she's like totally enmeshed in this. But she's also had an extra 40, 50, 60 years to see our advancements, to learn about us. You know, athletes. I'm talking women athletes. Yeah. And I think she feels very connected now. And I know she was trying to feel connected. She said, "I didn't do sports, but I knew she was a tap dancer, a hoofer. And that was good." I said, "Well, dance is sports. I mean, sports is dance. So try to connect on that." But I could tell they're so in their heads. They're kind of from the neck up, a lot of the intellectuals.
It's an intellectual,
It's from the neck up. And we have to use all of ourselves. And I was trying to explain that. And it's not that we don't use our brains too, but we just have to kind of connect all of ourselves.
Isn't that an issue? Wasn't that part of the problem of progress, in a sense that you know, a lot of the activism and the movement was it was heady, and it was, you know, in the streets and whatnot, but they were not interested in sports in general, even as consumers. So wasn't that part of the struggle, was how do you get women to engage in sports as consumers and fans and supportive masses?
Yes, but also women are huge fans. Women, if the women all of a sudden said, of course, this is now, you know, after COVID, during COVID, if we're, say, pre-COVID.
Okay.
That if the women said, "We're not going to buy tickets anymore to the NFL, to the NBA, and to ice hockey, and to, which is all men."
Yeah.
I think it's at least 40% of the sales.
Really?
I don't think women have any idea the power they have, ever. That's why I want them to follow the money. And I want people to understand, when a woman leads, she leads for everyone. And what people do when women lead, we only lead for women. And it gets me crazy, because that keeps our marketplace half as big. Here's the usual thing. "Billy, thanks what you did for women's tennis. I fought for pro tennis, and then the pro tennis hurt the women, actually, because the men wanted to get rid of us." No, I've always fought for tennis, but people always put me in, "Oh, you're always fighting for gender equity." I am fighting for gender equity, but I'm fighting for anyone who doesn't get paid equally for equal work. So the women happen to be really low on the totem pole there, so of course I have to fight for them. We're under-resourced. But in general, when you fight for anybody, means you're fighting for everyone. And they don't ever say to a guy, "Thanks for what you did for men's tennis."
Yeah.
Ever. Right. And you know how many times when they talk about, "Oh, you throw like a grandmother." Do they ever use the word grandfather? Never. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been interviewed, even for this book. "Oh, you know, I was out in the yard, and, you know, I'm throwing like my grandmother." They didn't say my grandfather. It's a guy. But yet they use woman as a derogatory thing instead of their grandfather. I mean, you can hear it day in and day out as you go through the day. Tomboy. What is that?
And then also on the other side of that, Billy, it seems that, you know, when women do succeed and do amazing things athletically, then they start comparing them to men, you're just being yourself, and you're a human being doing a competitive job, right?
And the men can beat us. We've always said the men can beat us. We can beat, but we're just as entertaining. And sometimes we're more entertaining. Sometimes they're more entertaining. But we're all entertainers. But women, there's no way the top women can beat the top men. We've never, ever once claimed we have. The men keep bringing it up, saying, "Oh, you think you're better than we are?" No, we don't. Where we ever said that? That we never said it. We've never said we're better. We've always said the top guys will always be the top women. Next.
Want our place in the world.
Oh, my. Well, it depends what it is. Yeah, of course.
I start talking to people like in the arts about, you know, that there's so many kind of white men who are threatened by diversity because they think they're being pushed out. But the truth of the matter is the field is just more competitive and more voices are included.
But we were never in. That's what they don't. But they wanted to keep staying that way. It's not right.
Right.
It's not just about girls either. We're talking about people of color. We're talking about
people
with, living with disabilities. We're talking about everything in the. No, but it's so irritating. I get so, you can tell I get a little irritated.
Of course, because it's ongoing. It's, you know, it's.
It never it's ends. I can go through a day, every day I can point out stuff all day long.
So. Sure. But let me ask you something, though. I was wondering, like, isn't it amazing to you when you look back, the idea that a cigarette company was the primary benefactor that changed everything and changed your life?
Oh, yeah, because when Gladys Hellman, who was our leader, there's 9 of us that signed a $1 contract with Gladys Hellman in 1970. That was
this
the
was the women's
the original
tour?
Nine. The original nine is the essence of so many things and why things are so relevant today. When like when a woman athlete, particularly a woman tennis player, gets a check, it's because of that moment in time when we're willing to give up our entire careers for the future generations. And there are three elements. That any girl born in this world, if she's good enough, would have a place to compete. Number two, that she'd be appreciated for her accomplishments, not only her looks. And number three, to be able to make a living playing tennis. You know, her sport. You know, our sport.
This was the manifesto of the original nine?
This is it. This is the we've set and talked about this a long time. I said to them, if you expect to make a lot of money, if you expect a lot of applause, if you expect a lot of appreciation for this, don't do it. Do it because we know it's the right thing to do. And so we did it, and we got suspended, and then we didn't get... I mean, it was... You don't want to know. Every minute, things were changing. But that was the moment where it's the birth of women's professional tennis the way you know it today. So when you see Osaka make $55 million, that's the reason she's able to make that money and why we're able to grow the sport and why we're number one in women's sports as far as financially. It's because of that moment in time in 1970, and that's why I try to tell kids and people that it's really important to know your history because not only do you know about yourself more, you know how to shape the future because everyone is an influencer. Every single person's an influencer. You
especially now, you
don't know, especially now with social media, correct?
Yeah.
And you can mobilize faster. You can, oh my gosh, things are just speeding.
How did the relationship with Virginia Slims, what was that?
Oh,
was that,
well, Gladys Hellman comes up to me and says, oh, I got us a sponsor, Virginia Slims. And I go, Gladys, we're athletes. We can't do that. She says, well, you signed a dollar contract with me, which is my fault because I told her to sign us for a dollar because she said I can't afford a lot of money. I said, just sign us for a dollar. It's just as binding as $1 trillion. And she goes,
and she was an agent?
And she was a publisher of World Tennis Magazine.
Oh, okay.
And Larry and all of us wanted to get to her because owning a magazine meant advertising, right? And advertising meant she probably knew a lot of CEOs.
Yeah.
And that is correct. So she's the one that had a relationship with, you know, a friendship with Joseph Kallman, who used to be, he was the CEO, chairman of Philip Morris, and he believed in women and believed in women's tennis. And this Virginia Slims all of a sudden couldn't be on television commercials, right? In fact, the last one was 1970, I think December 31st on the Johnny Carson show.
Uh-huh.
And so... 71, guess what? They've got all this money they've been spending on television commercials, and now they can spend it on us. I had a hard time with that, but Gladys said, I'm your boss. Didn't you sign the $1 contract? I said, I sure did. She says, well, are you going to let me do this or not? And I said, you're the boss. I'll do whatever you want. So that's how that worked, and even after they weren't our sponsor, all those different people would help us in trying to shape the future of our sport. So I'm always indebted to them. We called him Uncle Joe because he, without him and without the company. And I must say, working with them, they had the most integrity of any company I've ever worked with.
Philip Morris?
Yeah, they were amazing. So I'm like, you never know, right? You never know what's
it's
going
just so,
to evolve.
The irony of it that, you know, with his support and, you know, with the even the corporate relationship with Philip Morris, that the one thing that was going to put women on the map in terms of, you know, beginning to earn what they deserve was literally a company that killed them.
Hey,
no, I
hear you.
It.
No, yeah. I hear you. It was not easy for me. Not.
Yeah.
But I also couldn't think just about myself.
Right. Well, I know. I mean, it was like that's that. But that's understanding the nature of politics.
Yep. But that's also leadership. You have to.
Sure.
Cannot.
Got to make decisions.
Yeah, it was rough. I must say it was rough because I don't smoke. So I never smoked. My dad, life coach,
yeah.
said,
yeah.
you know, if you're going to be an athlete, you don't drink or smoke.
And did he smoke or drink?
No, they didn't really drink. They had maybe one cocktail if they went out dancing, which was once a year. And then, because Randy and I would say, go out and dance, because we love to watch them dance. They're really good.
Yeah.
And then my dad would smoke a cigar, but not really smoke it when he was out doing watering the lawn. But he would never, uh-huh. but kind of a fake smoke thing.
Oh, yeah.
But,
yeah. yeah.
But he did chew tobacco. Oh, God,
did he?
For a while. It was so gross. I said, Daddy, you just, I don't want to be around. Gross. Can't stand it.
Spitting
so anyway,
it
that's baseball. You know, he was a baseball scout for a while. My dad was for the Brewers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we all love basketball first. But do you hear basketball any place in here?
Yeah,
there was nothing for girls in basketball when I was young. Nothing.
And
there
you had to chew tobacco. If you're involved with baseball, you
had to
chew tobacco.
I know, you had to, right? Oh, it's gross.
Yeah.
And you get cancer of the tongue, the esophagus. It's terrible. You know, don't.
It's all bad. So now, like, well, obviously, you know, your sort of public birth into being out was difficult and jarring, I imagine. And
yes.
How long did it really take you to sort of, you know, find peace with that? What was it that transitioned into something that you were able to be proud of?
I think therapy helped me the most, and I went to an eating disorder place.
Yeah, an eating disorder too, huh?
Oh, yeah, but that was part of it. I mean, they all go hand in hand a lot because it's
that's like a control issue, right?
Eating disorders are a distortion disorder because anorexics look in the mirror, which I'm not. I'm a binge eater and I don't purge, so I get fat. So, but I was at Renfrew in Philadelphia for 5 to 6 weeks. Lived there with most of them were teenagers and had anorexia nervosa, and I used to sit across from them. And they would brag if they had lost a quarter of a pound. They're very competitive. All of us are pretty much, most of the kids do pretty well in school. I was the oldest one there. It's all the same stuff, though. Eating disorders are about emotion.
Yeah.
But it's manifested differently. Some people feel like they have no control at all in life. So the one area that I've listened to with anorexic kids, people, is that they can have control over this. This is the one thing they control in their life. Everything else in their life they feel is out of control. So they hang on to this. Binge eaters, which I know myself, what I did is I ate to push my emotions down to the bottom, as far as I could get them down to the bottom of my stomach so I wouldn't feel, and I'd feel numb, the way somebody who drinks too much feels numb. We're trying to numb the pain. So that's the way I coped. Everyone has their different choice of agony, whatever.
I have eating issues. And
I'm
a man.
You have eating issues?
I do. My mother was anorexic. So, like, I was brought up with this idea that I was unacceptable if I was chubby. And it's the deepest issue I have. I can't shake it. Like, I have body dysmorphia and I'm nuts. And, it's difficult. But I've learned to live with it. And I stay healthy and I eat. But like it's not an hour goes by where I don't think about it.
I same with me, and I wake up every morning and I say, I have an eating disorder, just like I would say if I were an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic, because I find that when I own it, it does help me. It's when I try to push it away that I do worse. For me, everyone's different, but for me, that's what helps me the most. I just accept it. I take ownership of it. I think about food constantly. Every time I'm going to go eat, I go, oh, God, I have to think about this again. And I love food. I mean, I love it. I love to eat it. I love the taste. I love it.
I did it last night. I just went nuts.
What's the thing you really, I mean, I don't have any.
Well, for
it's
ice cream, but last night I just
ate. That used to be wine.
Yeah, I just ate an entire rotisserie chicken and, with hummus and bread.
Excellent. Was it delish?
Yeah, it was, but about a third of the way through, it's like I was like, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to eat this again.
I'll tell you what. Well, let's check in maybe in a week or so. We'll see how the chicken is going. If you can still eat it or not. How's that?
Yeah.
No, okay. But it's really hard. It's painful. It's horrible.
How long was it? You had it all your life?
I think, yeah, we in therapy, you know, they ask you about when do you remember the first time and feelings.
Right.
I'd say 11, you know, and usually for girls it's around puberty, and that's me. And
so was it directly connected with you knowing that you were attracted to women?
Oh, no. I didn't know that at all. Not until I was in my 20s or late teens. Late teens or 20s. Well, 50%, I don't know if this is still true. It used to be. 50% of kids, people know if they're gay or if they want to be a transgender girl or boy or something. 50% before you're 18, before I'm 18. And 50% after you're 18. Now, I don't know. That probably has shifted now because of the way society views us. And views me. So I would think maybe more than 50% before 18. But before 18, no idea. When I walk in the room, I saw Larry across the room. I'm like, yeah, baby. He's the one. Yeah, no.
You guys had a good time for the time you were together?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love Larry. And, you know, Lana and I are the godmothers of his children and Nancy's children and
Like the evolution of your identity is actually a great story, and it doesn't always go that way, you know.
No, it doesn't. It's been difficult. People say, "What's the most difficult part of my journey?" I'd say my sexuality.
Really, because
that, like the big chicken over there.
Exactly.
I get it.
But
when you talk like that, I get that. I get
sure.
it.
Sure. Yeah, I do it too. I don't know that I ever thought of it as stuffing my feelings, but it's probably that. I just, you know, it makes perfect sense.
Have you ever gone to anybody to talk about it?
It's odd. I haven't gone to anybody to talk about that specifically in a deep way, but I have talked about it, but it really is. And, you know, I'm sober 22 years, so that's still my deepest issue is that food thing, man. And, you know, fuck.
So you've been sober for how many years?
22 years.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah. You know, that's okay.
How did you do that, though?
You know, the way you do it with the meetings. You go to the secret society.
Oh, so did you go to AA?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's good.
Yeah.
I've been to some general AA meetings. Actually, Elton John took me to one.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you know, they have open house like on Christmas Day in London, in England for AA. Uh-huh. You can bring somebody.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I went with him. Uh-huh. It was amazing.
How's he doing?
Oh, my God, he's doing great. We just stayed with him and David and the boys, I don't know, a few weeks ago.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was good to see him because, it's with COVID, we haven't been able to see him as much. And we talk, you know, and send notes, but
yeah,
not the same as being with them. And the boys are growing up. Oh, my God, Zach and Elijah. And it's really adorable. But, no, Elton's, you know, getting ready to go back out on the road with his farewell tour if he can get going. And then, you know,
God,
he really, I'm very excited because I think in 22, he's going to do his last farewell tour, which I doubt will really happen, but at Dodger Stadium, you know, he did Dodger Stadium in 75 and for a couple of days, and it was just amazing. I was there with him, and it was just amazing experience.
He must love it. These guys must love it to keep doing it. I mean, I don't, you know.
Of course they love it. I mean, the trouble with being a jock or an athlete is you better do it when you're young because you're not going to get a second chance like musicians or
you can't
or stand-ups like you.
Yeah,
or,
you can't keep doing a farewell tour every few years.
I know. Why not? Whatever they want.
No, but
Rolling
I mean,
Stone,
as an athlete.
Keep going,
as an athlete, you can't.
No, you cannot. People are saying, well, you know, you can keep playing. And I go, I'm not Frank Sinatra and I can't sing with my knees because my knees were, I had knee operations. I go, you guys, I don't think I can sing with my knees, so I think that's out.
What about, I just want to know to get back on it. What about the identity struggle made it the worst thing? Was it that because you judged yourself that you didn't want to be or
it was very shame-based. I mean, my parents are homophobic. I was grew up homophobic probably, and I'm sure I did, and just coming to grips with it. And the eating is definitely related to it, so I have to. Oh God, I'm constantly. The eating is the only thing I don't have to worry about my identity anymore. I'm very comfortable with that now, even though occasionally I get a little stomach. Sometimes, depending upon where I am and the situation I'm in.
But also, when I really think about what's going on with gender and sexuality now, that you know you. We're right there with Dr. Renee Richards at, you know, really one of the first kind of cultural moments around trans people and what rights they have.
Yes, It was a real privilege to get to know her, and she's still in our life as one of our friends, and she's our ophthalmologist, although she's retiring, so she's only working one day a week, and she's in her 80s. But Ilana, my partner in life, wife, whatever, I've said partner for so many years. It's fun. That it's weird to say wife, but she's my wife. That Ilana was the number one player in the world in doubles.
Yeah.
Ilana played Renee as a male and then as a female.
Uh-huh.
Because Renee said to me one day, there's only one person who's beaten me as a male and a female, and I bet you don't know who that is. I said, oh, yes, I do. It's Ilana. And she starts cracking up. Yeah, you do know.
Do you find that, do you think that, like, it, that sports in and of itself is still pretty homophobic?
I think men have a lot harder time now than women. But no, I think it's gotten much better, particularly in women's sports. But men's sports, what's the guy's name? Carl Nassib. Is it with the Raiders? He came out and everyone supported him. We need more men like that to come out. But we also need the quarterbacks of these teams. I get upset. Like a couple of linemen said they support him and the association supports him, you know, the Players Association. But I want to hear the quarterbacks of those teams, because a quarterback is considered the leader of a team. And we need the quarterbacks to step up and say, I'm for this guy. He's part of our team. It's just like what Bill Russell said years ago. Leslie Visser, a great writer, was telling me that and this is way back in the 60s and 70s, and they asked Bill Russell about it, and he said, well, can they shoot? That's all he cared about, which is exactly the way we should think about it.
That's right. But you do need to, you know, someone to step up, not unlike you did with, you know, Dr. Richards. And
you got to step up, right.
Yeah. But the interesting thing now, from what I understand, within women's, within the feminist community, is it's still a sort of kind of evolving issue around acceptance of trans athletes. Is that true?
Trans athletes is going through, yes, they're going through a lot, because some people think they shouldn't be able to participate. And this is an ongoing thing. What I want is that everyone have a chance to compete or play. So we got to figure this out. Everyone keeps just pointing to testosterone, but the more I talk to scientists that are in this, that study this area, it's just not that simple. You metabolize, every human being metabolizes it differently. There's been two guys, for instance, that if you measure their testosterone, they would be considered feminine, but they won two gold medals in men's. I mean, these are guys that they've been measured. And no one's ever heard about them, but I know of these things because I listen to the scientists. And I don't think it's that easy. But bottom line, we're going to have to figure it out. It's not cut and dry. So I think we need to keep listening to the scientists as they keep studying this thoroughly. But bottom line, I want every human being to have a chance to compete and play, just like the Paralympians. And the Paralympians,
and as the human beings that they want to be.
Correct. So that's what I, just Billie Jean King. Some of the athletes think that I'm out to lunch and I'm wrong, and they shouldn't be allowed to compete. Martina Navratilova is one of them.
She thinks you're wrong?
She thinks I'm totally wrong. And we've had a discussion. I said, Martina, you may be right, and I totally hear you. I appreciate what you say, but all I want personally for me, Billie Jean King, and I think the Women's Sports Foundation probably, is that we want everyone to have a chance to play and compete. So we got to figure out the answer.
How does it make you feel when, like, you see, like in the, like Simone Biles, you know, that people are publicly having, you know, being open about the mental strain and emotional strain and stress of being professional athletes?
I think it's good. I think it's brave. I think it took a lot of courage. I also think she cared about the team to make sure they were going to medal, because if she stayed in it, they were not going to. So I thought that was a great leadership moment for her. I think it's good when we hear their truth, but I think we need to do a better job of like rookie school, where we teach and tell them what it takes to be a professional athlete. But remember the gymnast. But they were very abused by their doctor. Remember Dr. Nassar?
Yeah.
So that is so traumatic. And when you get under any kind of stress, like, of course, the competition in the Olympics is, that alone can be a trigger that's going to set you off into mental challenges and emotional challenges. So with gymnastics, there's so many of those women were abused by this horrible doctor, Dr. Nassar. So I think
as big an issue as the Catholic Church. I mean, that was out of control. It was crazy.
Totally. And it's all, you know, another place we think it's out of control, I'm not sure yet, is cheerleading. So we need to really get in there and investigate that area as well. Huh. I'm just starting to hear it rumbles, and a lot of people are starting to come to me in the last 2 or 3 weeks saying,
really?
If you think the gymnastics are bad, this cheerleading is terrible. So we've got to really pay attention to predators and people who are inappropriate.
Yeah, and I think also, like, you know, getting back to, you know, people, you know, and identity, and it's just that it seems to me that, especially with Dr. Richards, that, you know, when people meet people, you know, outside of the way they think about the idea or the issue, you know, something shifts. And I think there's a lot of distance between people's ideas of what's right and wrong and who people are and who they actually are. And I think that you, by stepping into that with Renee Richards, you know, you gave the culture the opportunity to see her as a human and not an idea or a moral problem.
Well, that's interesting you said, because the women didn't want her when they first heard about her coming on. They were like crazed. What about the locker room? What about this? I go, everybody calm down. I'm going to go talk to doctors. You can do the same. Mm. And then I'm going to call Renee. And I went and talked to doctors. I did call Renee. Renee and I had a 4-hour meeting, and I listened to her stories, and I went to the doctors, and I said, is she considered a woman or not? And they said, yes, she is. I said, that's all I need to know. Went back to the women, and they're like up in arms, and I said, okay, I'm just going to ask you to do one thing. I want you to accept her for at least 2 weeks on the tour, okay?
Yeah.
And they all kind of calmed down, and they said, okay, that's fair enough. Within 2 days of Renee being on the tour, all the women are coming to me. She is so nice. She's the greatest. And to your point, what you just talked about is how you look at people differently once you get to know them.
Mm-hmm.
And once the players, our players got to know her, then they just love her. That was it. Done.
That's great. Now, last question. How are you treated by these new... you know, these new champions, in like the Williams sisters in particular.
I've known them since, this is scary, 1988 when they were 7 and 8 years old.
Wow.
Actually, in the book, there's a photos of them. We found them. You cannot believe this took 3 years. We found these photos.
Yeah.
Because I kept saying the Long Beach Press Telegraph was there that day. They have to. It was in Long Beach, California, where I'm from, and they live nearby.
Yeah.
And that's the day I met them, when they were 7 and 8. So I have known them since then. They're wonderful. They were on the Fed Cup teams. I was captain, which is the World Cup teams of tennis, for women's tennis. So I got to know them pretty well. And, you know, and Venus stepped up for equal prize money in 2005. We got equal prize money with the majors in 07. And she actually won Wimbledon in 07. It was absolutely perfect that she won, that Venus won Wimbledon in 2007 to celebrate equal prize money in all four majors. And she was the front person for the players at that time. We needed someone current. And she was the one. And then Serena has always fought for women's issues and equality, and also particularly, obviously, women of color. She and her husband are doing unbelievable investments in business. I'm really lucky to know these two kids. Not to me, they're always kids, but to know them and to see how they've excelled, you know, and also life after tennis. They're going to be amazing.
You've really been a major influence on so much of the fights that, you know, were hard won and still go on. But, you know, it's a real honor talking to you.
It's great talking to you, Mark. And, I've seen you through the years on the night shows. And, and this is going great, huh?
WTF? Yeah, I'm doing all right. I'm doing okay. Now I just got to learn. I got to learn how to play tennis. That's what I need to learn.
Well, why don't you get Craig out there, your brother?
I know. I got to get him out.
He'll teach you. He'll hit the ball to you.
Yeah,
he can teach it to you. Maybe he'll start having fun again with it.
That's a good. That's a good idea. Yeah, he likes his pickle. The pickleball is where he's at.
That's fine. Pickleball, and go play pickle. Whatever works for anybody. What makes them happy. All the racket sports are amazing sports for people. Tennis has been voted the number one healthiest sport, and swimming. Okay, those are the two top.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to play some more tennis.
All right. To be continued. Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Bye bye.
Billie Jean King, again, the book, All In, an autobiography, is available now wherever you get books. Now, let me play some, I don't know, it's kind of, I don't know, I'm just going to plunk around. Fonda, Monkey, Cat Angels everywhere, man.